Hey, it's Francis. You are about to get into a strange and beautiful world. The world of cheese. Not just cheese, but cheese people. Like people who will answer every question on cheese, who will teach us how to look and smell and see cheese the way they do, and people who will battle each other over their mastery and love of cheese. This is an episode from a couple of years ago. It was one of my favorite episodes to make, and we're psyched to bring it back to you. Ain't easy being cheesy, y'all. Have a listen. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Okay, so it's bedtime. Your teeth are brushed, your jammies are on, and you're saying a little prayer of thanks for your favorite thing in the universe, cheese. So you send one up for all the cows of the world, and then you remember the goats and the sheep, so they get one too. Then the farmers, the goat herders, and shepherds. And then the cheesemakers, and one more prayer for the affineurs and the cave masters. And then you drift off to sleep, but you forgot one person. And maybe the most important one of all, the cheesemonger. Because what good is the greatest cheese in the world if you don't know about it? It's okay, I guess. Because cheesemongers are kind of used to getting no love. You know, people think they just stand there behind the counter and, I don't know, play with plastic wrap all day. But there is art and science and wildly precise skill to what they do. This week, we're all about the world of the cheesemonger. We have one solving all your cheese problems with us. We have one teaching us how to taste and identify cheeses. And to start us off, we have the Cheesemonger Invitational. So when I first heard about the Cheesemonger Invitational, I kind of couldn't believe it. It is a day-long competition to crown the best cheesemonger in the land with a series of brutal and exacting tests. We sent the reporter Ryan Kyleth there to check out how it went down, and he's back. Hey, Ryan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Francis.
So, the Cheesemonger Invitational. This is a cheese trade show, basically, right? But it's also become this place where, you know, dreams come true and hopes are dashed against the rocks. Yeah. What is it?
It's funny because, you know, I feel bad that you're always talking to fancy chefs and culinary experts, and I'm just a dude who went to a thing. I have no food knowledge whatsoever.
That is what makes one an expert.
But this thing, the Cheesemonger Invitational, you know, it's open to the public. And on that side, it seems very simple. You show up at 3, 4 in the afternoon, something like that. You eat some cheese for a few hours, drink some beers, have some of the food that's out, and then you go home. What I saw going to this for you guys was all of the literal scaffolding behind that. I mean, I was there at 8 a.m. when they were building the stage.
Okay.
And that's when the cheesemongers arrived.
Okay.
They were preparing. They were up till 4 a.m. making pastry doughs to prepare for their presentations and bites and things like that.
Yeah.
So the behind the scenes was the underneath the water part of the iceberg on this thing was huge.
Yeah. And so before all the guests arrived, there's this huge competition. What are they competing on? What are the skills they're trying to show off?
I will have to look at the list because there were so many tests. But better is if you hear the guy who runs the whole Cheesemonger Invitational talk about it. His name's Adam Moskowitz. He's like a third-generation cheesemonger, cheese world person. Here he is talking about the day.
So right now we are in Brooklyn, New York City. It is Saturday morning. We just started the competition rounds for the Cheesemonger Invitational. We got about 45 cheesemongers inside. They're taking a written test, and then they're going to go into a taste test, and then they're going to go into an aroma test. From there, they're going to jump into the technical rounds. They're going to cut a quarter pound. They're going to wrap a quarter pound, and then they're going to wrap a half a wheel of cheese. From there, they're going to jump into the food service rounds, where they're going to do a beverage pairing with a pre-assigned cheese, then a perfect plating on a slate with a pre-assigned cheese, and then finally they're going to bring a perfect bite, like an amuse-bouche, with cheese being the center of the plate. At that moment, we're also going to be open to the public, where we have the finest purveyors of the specialty cheese showing and sharing their wares. Basically, the finest cheese on the planet.
So you can get a sense of this dude, Adam Moskowitz. He's basically powering this entire thing with the energy of his personality. At one point, he was wearing a cow onesie with a cowbell around his neck and a baseball cap, like pumping his fist in the air, pumping up the crowd, you know.
But okay, so he names written tests, aroma tests, taste tests. What are some of these tests that like really stood out to you?
The one as a layperson that I guess for a cheese person, this is not difficult at all. But the aroma test, where they had cheeses hidden inside a sort of canister with, you know, cloth over the top, and they just had to smell it and name the cheese, like, very specifically, not like the family, not like this is a Gouda. They had to name the brand, et cetera.
Really?
Yeah, that was cool. And then, of course, there was the cutting one, where, you know, you have to cut a quarter pound exactly. And I think this all of us can relate to because, you know, whether it's at the butcher or the cheese counter or whatever, it's always awesome when you order a quarter pound and you watch them cut it and then they throw it on the thing and it's actually 0.25. Like, that's amazing. And you and the person, you share a little like, ah.
Ding, 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 ding.
Exactly. They were judged on how often can you hit 0.25 exactly on the scale.
Oh, that's so interesting. There's a salesmanship test.
Yeah. So the salesmanship challenge, which all of these guys and women had to go through, is basically selling cheese. And this is the part that I had not considered before, which is, you know, obviously the cheese gets center stage.
Sure.
And also, I think the cheese maker, a lot of prestige there. The person who does not get a lot of attention is the person that most of us deal with, which is the person at the cheese counter selling it. And so this, they called it the salesmanship challenge, is like, yeah, how well can you sell? And so we have a clip of one of the contestants, David Myers.
Here we go. 3, 2, 1.
Hi, how's it going today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. You look like you haven't had a bite of cheese in a second. Would you like some little snacks while you look around?
Absolutely.
This is one of the last three completely traditional cheddars left in the entire world, made by the Somerset Gorge the Cheddar Gorge in Somerset, England, where cheddar originally got its name, and it tastes almost like mustard to me.
Yeah, this might be great. I'm looking for some picnic cheeses today.
Oh,
can you recommend a great picnic cheese?
Fantastic. This is one of my favorites for sure. But let's see, how many people are you serving at this picnic?
We're going to be about four.
Four people.
All right. And do you want to have leftovers, or do you just want to go all out in one little...
Well, it's going to be hot, so probably not.
All right. Let's see. I really like this Roth Grand Cru Sur Choix. It's perfect out under the open sky. It's got really nice alpine, nutty, caramely flavors. This is made in the style of traditional French and Swiss alpine cheeses like Gruyere, and it tastes kind of caramelized. Really good crowd pleaser.
I like them both, but I think I might be looking for something in the goat's milk family.
Oh, absolutely. Ooh, try this one. It tastes like goat milk marshmallows. This is Broadbender. This is a goat milk Gouda, just aged about 6 months. And despite having no sugar or lactose in it, it has a flavor that's quite candy-like.
So how do you do it? I mean, is that a good...
I watched a lot of these.
Yeah.
He was nervous.
Yeah, you can kind of get that vibe.
He was sweating on the cheese a little bit.
That's disgusting. Points off for getting sweat on the cheese.
Yeah, but the judges were all like Cheese World professionals.
Mm-hmm.
In the backroom machinations later, they were definitely tearing into some of these people. Oh, I talked to this person. It was 5 minutes before they even offered me a taste of cheese, you know, grade F or whatever.
Oh,
so
wow.
He did well with that. He immediately got this cheese judge a slice of cheese and kept it going. Also, they weren't selling. You heard the judge in that clip. They weren't selling to average people. This judge said, oh, you know, I was looking for something more in the goat family.
Yeah,
that's not something I say at the cheese counter.
But, okay, so after this whole day, it was a day-long thing.
Yeah, I got there at 10 a.m., and they were still going when I left at 9 p.m., you know.
Whoa. So, Ryan, this is, like, maybe backing up, but, like, what is a cheesemonger?
Yeah, good question. Really, it's marketing and sales, but they've dressed it up with a much fancier and more pleasant term. The cheesemonger is the person who tells you what you want.
Right.
Because for me, certainly, and probably for a lot of us, we show up at that cheese case, it's overwhelming, it's intimidating, we don't know, and they tell us, oh, this is what you want.
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe it costs a little bit more than the other one, but...
That's so cynical. Okay, so the whole thing was a competition, and because I can't resist, who won?
Yeah, so some crowd favorites sort of started to float to the top. And one of the guys that I had my money on ended up being the winner. So the way that it worked was, you know, there's this battery of tests during the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the afternoon, the public is let in.
Yeah.
So all of these cheese drink pairings and cheese hors d'oeuvres and these cheese plates, they were all coming out on like huge sheet pans. And that's what the public got to enjoy. All these 45 different pairings from all of these different mongers in bulk. And that's what the judges were trying, too. And then at the very end of the day, that stage that was being built, they got the finalists up there, and they did all the tests in public.
Okay.
They did the aroma test, they did the cutting test, and the weighing test, and the answering cheese trivia. In fact, I think we even have a clip of cheese trivia.
Now we're going to ask the cheesemongers
some very hard trivia questions. Here we go.
Does anyone get body slammed
question
at the end of
this? Number one. What does FSMA stand for? What does FSMA, FSMA, stand for? Don't give them the answers. You don't shout it out.
Yeah. I can't answer trivia questions with this guy yelling at me.
Yeah, you could tell the crowd was real into
the
that.
The crowd was,
lots of cheering.
Was really
at
feeling the, it.
At this point in the night, the crowd was drunk on the free beer and wine and cheese. And sort of, there were friends and family who were paying lots of attention to the goings on stage. But sure. Most people were wandering out in a dairy coma of sorts.
Yeah. So what are the stakes? Does it mean something for someone to do well in this competition?
Yeah, and this will get me to the eventual winner. You know, what Adam told me is that the past winners have all, like, had marked jumps in their career. You know, they've gone from cheese seller to cheese shop owner, or, you know, they've gotten a stake in a cheese-making business or something like that. Magazine profiles, radio appearances, the kind of thing that can really elevate their career. So the winner, who I don't know that I called it, but he was in my top five, a local guy from here in New York, from Eataly downtown. His name is Eric Shack. And I think we have the tape of him winning.
Ladies and gentlemen, your current Cheesemonger Invitational champion, a man who put his heart into it like I've never seen before. Ladies and gentlemen, Eric Shack. Say a few words.
I don't even know where to start. I want to thank everybody up here. All of you guys are f***ing amazing. No, seriously, like, everybody up here, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be swearing.
He was in tears.
This industry, it saves lives. It makes people incredible. I've had some of the most amazing mentors.
You know, that Queen song, it's the most ultimate cliche, but it works every time.
It works every time. It really sets the mood.
Well, good job, Eric Shack. All right, Ryan. Well, thank you so much for the report. I hope you, too, feel like a champion.
Hey, thank you for sending me. This is not the kind of... I'm a business reporter. This is not the kind of thing I ever go to. So this was a great day for me, too.
Maybe this could change your career.
Maybe I'll be seeing you guys again very soon. Yeah.
Ryan Kyleth is a freelance reporter for public radio and podcasts. Coming up next, the delightful cheesemonger, Griselda Powell, teaches us how to taste and smell and touch our way through a cheese case. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
After hearing about the Cheesemonger Invitational, I could not get it out of my head that there are people who can seriously identify cheeses just by their scent. I wanted a pro to help me understand how to do it. So I went to Murray's Cheese in Greenwich Village, New York. And when you walk into the shop, right by the door, there's this grilled cheese station and the whole place just smells incredible. And then you see all the people huddled by the counter.
All right, who has the number of needs help? Raise your hand.
You'll probably hear that voice. That was my mentor for the day, the irrepressible Griselda Powell. She's a cheesemonger, a natural teacher, and she even came with a handout, a cheese aroma wheel.
So what we try to do is help customers develop a vocabulary.
Yeah.
And when they try the cheese and they're like, ooh, this is good, what makes it good? Mm. What does it remind you of? Is there a connection to something from your memory?
Yeah.
So with this flavor and aroma wheel, it's basically broken down into particular sections. It could be lactic, which is basically something that's very milky tasting. Mm-hmm. Like, does it taste like butter or yogurt? It could be vegetal. Like, we have cheeses that sort of remind you of cauliflower and broccoli. Mm-hmm. Like, camemberts tend to be very vegetal.
Oh, yeah.
It could have a floral taste. We have this one beautiful cheddar from Missouri called Flory's Truckle. And when you bite into it, you taste all these floral flavors that just explode in your mouth.
Oh, cool.
It could be fruity. It could be like toast. It could be animally, a gamey.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something spicy, like it reminds you of cinnamon and nutmeg or something like Christmas flavors that you get when you make like gingerbread.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you're just trying to connect these flavors with, you know, something that you can find in that cheese.
It helps build a vocabulary.
Build a vocabulary.
Yeah.
A lot of our customers feel a bit overwhelmed.
Yeah.
But as a cheesemonger, our goal is to get them to relax and introduce them to the joy of eating cheese and basically break it down for them in order for them to feel comfortable when they walk out, or at least they have them feel comfortable enough that they know they got a good piece of cheese that they can take home and eat and watch Netflix and put up their feet. Get a nice blue and a tiny port and listen to some Al Green or something.
Which one goes well with Al Green?
Oh, okay. This is what I tell my customers. There is this one blue cheese that we get in the holiday. It's called Rogue River Blue. It's in
Oregon.
From Oregon.
I randomly know that one, and it's amazing.
It is amazing. Get that, a port, turn down the lights. Love and happiness, Al Green. Mm. That's all you need
love
in life.
Love and happiness.
Ooh. So we have fun here at Murray's.
Okay, so I'm excited to start this. Mm-hmm. And this is
one.
Cheese number one.
Cheese number one. So just sort of feel it. What does it feel like to you?
It's slightly rubbery.
Yeah.
Soft, not a whole lot of tension. It wants to crack, but it's a little bendy, and now I break it open.
And then start smelling it. What do you smell?
Oh, boy. This is the thing, right? Because I'm like, it smells like cheese. But I definitely smell a saltiness, like almost standing by the sea kind of saltiness.
Great.
I smell a little bit of, I think in the wine world, they gently call barnyard.
Barnyard is a very good description. Try tasting it.
Delicious.
Thank you.
I don't get any of that barnyardy, animal-y mm-hmm. flavor at first.
Mm-hmm.
It comes through later,
mm-hmm.
and now I'm sort of getting to the end and sort of riding out in a way that is buttery, but not extremely buttery.
Yeah. So what this cheese is called Pyrenees Brebis. So Pyrenees Brebis mm-hmm. is a sheep's milk cheese from the Pyrenees region of France. I like calling it Manchego's French cousin.
Mm-hmm.
So Manchego is also in the Pyrenees region, but in Spain.
Oh, right
so
on.
When you sort of look at the way these two cheeses are made, essentially, what you're really looking at from a difference perspective is really the terroir from the Spanish side of the Pyrenees region versus the French side.
Different weather, different grasses and flowers and microbiome.
Right. I think it has the nuttiness of Manchego.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this has a little bit more complexity. And the other thing I really like about this cheese is just very approachable, very snackable. Mm-hmm. And since it's also a sheep milk cheese, one of the things that we always notice with sheep milk cheeses is that they tend to be more nuttier, just in general. So when in like the CMI competition, the Cheesemongers Invitational, when they're trying to do so like a blind taste, if you taste something that's going to become really nutty, particularly like hazelnutty, you know, chances are it could be more of a sheep cheese than
that
something else.
That helps you narrow it down.
Yes.
So that was my question about that contest, because I'm like, to do a blind tasting contest, like, I don't know what this cheese is, and taste it and tell me what it is, mm-hmm. is it just, you just have to memorize every cheese, or is it, oh, you can actually figure things out as you're tasting?
I think that the key is that there's times in which you can, like, use certain keys to narrow it down. When you start looking at goat, it's going to be a little bit more grassy. And we talk about nutty for sheep. Cow's going to be a little bit more creamy or butterier. So that helps you narrow it down.
All right,
let's go to the next one.
Okay.
And smell. What do you smell?
Oh, wow. I smell almost like a... It's not quite lemony, mm-hmm. but there's a little, like, an acidic fruit.
Okay, yes. Kind there's of thing a little bit on. Of fruitiness going on there. To me, I smell a little bit of sourness, like maybe buttermilk or a yogurt or something very lactic.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's try tasting it.
It's funny because I do taste a lot of that tang, that sort of cultured buttermilky tang. Almost like a chocolatiness.
Oh, very good.
It's kind of making like the corners of my mouth start to water a little bit.
A little salivation.
Yeah, a little bit from the acid, I think. Also super delicious, but it that doesn't help anyone anywhere.
This is called Eltavice. This mm-hmm. is a French Alpine cheese, which I really enjoy. So when you think about Alpine cheeses, you know, with the cows going up in the Heidi world of the Swiss Alps, it is made the same way as like your Gruyères, mm-hmm. your Emmenthalers. Alpine is a classification of cheese, and it's basically how it's made. Basically, they heat up the milk and then the curds. Mm-hmm. From a customer standpoint, when people don't know the word Alpine, they always say, I want like a Swiss cheese.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so what we try to do is steer them from the familiar of a Swiss to something like this with the Eltavice, which, you know, you get a little other flavors. Like I was saying, that whole lactic buttermilky. You tasted chocolate, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And the different Alpine cheeses, even though they're made the same way, they all have different taste profiles.
And how do you know it's an Alpine cheese if you're just tasting it?
Well, first of all, I think the first thing that we were noticing is that it was the milkiness, that mm-hmm. lactic. So we know that's, chances are, it's a cow's milk cheese.
Sure, okay.
And when you were looking at how it was structured, the way it sort of like breaks off mm-hmm. and crunches, that's a characteristic of an Alpine mm-hmm. cheese.
Oh, that's so wild.
Yeah. These are great for fondues, grilled cheese, mac and cheese, anything that you're looking for as a melter. Alpines, that's what they're designed for.
Yeah. It's got a tiny, tiny, tiniest bit of funk.
Yes. And it's interesting you talk about funk, because if a person is sort of like afraid of funky cheeses, you know, we can like sort of introduce them to the world of funk using this Alpine cheese that like the Chef or Max or even this.
Yeah, it's like a Bruno Mars cheese. Like,
that's it.
Like,
and speaking of funk, we're going to the next cheese. This is a George Clinton cheese.
Yes.
Okay.
I love it. It's squishy in the hands. It's like squishier than Play-Doh.
Yeah, pasty almost.
Pasty.
Yes.
And when you actually rip it open, it's like a little bit stringy and sticking together.
Yeah. And what do you smell?
I smell like rind. I smell mold. I smell like going into like a... I smell like a salami.
Yes. It's almost very meaty.
Yeah.
Yes. And also, when you taste it, you need to try it with the rind.
Okay. I get a lot of taste experience in my mouth, my palate, like around, all the way around my tongue, but in the very center of my tongue, it almost feels like there's like a little island where you can like perch on and not be overwhelmed. You know what I mean?
I love that description.
But yeah, my overwhelming sensation is mushroomy, mm-hmm. foresty.
So this is called Fiaccio del Cabra. It is an Italian goat's milk cheese. Mm. This type of cheese is called a wash rind cheese, and what other people would consider calling stinky cheeses. What happens with the wash rind cheese is that you take this young cheese and you either wash it with a salt water brine solution mm-hmm. or maybe beer. wine or whatever, and you continue to periodically wash it and turn it. And if you sort of look at the other rye, it seems rather orangey.
Yeah.
That orange is basically a particular mold. We call it B. linens. And that's what is developing on this cheese as you wash it. And the B. linens gives it a meaty taste. So, okay.
It definitely finishes very animally.
It's animally, very gamey.
Yeah.
And that's the characteristic of a washed rind cheese. Gaminess, funkiness. People always say, like, stinky feet. I say it's like, you know, that bag of Fritos that you left in your locker in junior high for, like, 3 weeks, that type of funkiness.
Is that better than stinky feet? I guess.
But the whole notion is that with the washed rind cheeses, those are the particular characteristics. You look at the color of this cheese compared to the other ones. This is a little bit whiter.
Yeah, very white.
Compared to the other two. Goat's milk cheeses tend to be white.
Okay. It's like another thing you could store in your head.
Right.
If I'm identifying.
The orange color in the rind tends to mean that chances are it's a wash rind. The fact that it feels very tacky, another clue towards a wash rind. This cheese that you just had, the focaccia di Cabra, is basically made in a Taleggio style instead of cow. It is goat's milk.
So it's much more chill, like, in terms of the,
yes,
the aroma. Yeah.
So it does have some of the characteristics, but you can see how, if you make it the same way, but you change the milk, you can see how that profile changes.
And that's another way to start, again, piecing together a pattern for how you learn about these things. It's not just sheer memorization.
Correct.
Everything has
a rhyme or reason, yes.
Yeah.
So when you start thinking about goat tends to be a little bit more barnyardy. Sheep tends to be more nutty. Cow tends to be more buttery, a little bit like sweet cream. So that's sort of, those are sort of like the little clues. And as you start learning these, it helps you figure out which direction you're going to. And then hopefully either you can narrow it down, or at least get a good 50-50 chance of, you know, give it down to two cheeses.
Yeah. This is great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
This is a cool lesson. Griselda Powell is a cheesemonger at Murray's Cheese on Bleecker Street in New York City. And if you're ever in town, go say hi. She is amazing. All right, we are taking your calls. As always, our number is 1-800-537-5252, and it is more cheese. Cheese all day. Cheese all the time. Today, we have a guest in the studio with me, the fabulous Tia Keenan, cheesemonger, activist, and author of the books The Art of the Cheese Plate and Melt, Stretch, and Sizzle, The Art of Cooking Cheese. Tia, you ready to take some calls?
I am. I'm so excited.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah.
We have Eddie from Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Eddie, what's going on?
Hi, how are you?
All right, I'm here with Tia Keenan. That's the other voice you hear, cheese expert. And what can we talk about?
Excellent. Well, I have a question about blue cheese, right? So I often have a really hard time pairing the right blue cheese, say, with like a cheese plate or like putting on a pizza or using it for cream sauce. Because I know there's so many varieties of cheeses, but then the blue cheeses are like a mystery to me. And when I buy them randomly, I'll say, oh, I'll just try this one. They're super pungent, really strong, and I can't really enjoy them. So I kind of want to figure out what are great for, like, crackers and jam, what, you know, what I can use on salads, and what are actually blue cheeses that are milder.
Okay, that's a great question. You know,
I know
think
there's
something...
There's a few pieces to that, so...
Definitely. As complex as blue cheeses, actually.
Exactly.
So I think it's important to think about, you know, blue cheese is a very broad category encompassing mild, soft, sort of lightly blue cheeses, and then, you know, on the far end, intense, craggy, deeply blue cheeses. So I want to maybe shout out what I think some blue cheeses that you would enjoy are, and I want to talk a little bit about texture. Because a big part of how we experience the flavor of a cheese is about the texture of that cheese. So one of the reasons, for instance, that people tend to gravitate toward creamier blue cheeses is that the butter fat of a creamy blue cheese sort of helps ameliorate the intensity of the flavor.
Okay.
So I'm going to peg you as someone who would be more attracted to a creamier blue cheese. Now, when I think about the mildest, creamiest, most sort of user-friendly blue cheese, I'm thinking about something like a Gorgonzola Cremificato or a Gorgonzola Dolce. These are milder, very creamy, almost sort of floral, fruity blue cheese. Now, Gorgonzola does come in a range of styles, okay?
Yes.
So, right. So Cremificato would be the mildest and most creamiest blue cheese. Now, it's a great cheese for a cheese plate, but it's also a really good cheese for making sauces because you're kind of already halfway there to a cream sauce. Yeah. The cheese itself is so creamy already.
Like, Cremificato means, like, creamified. Already,
yeah.
Essentially, right?
Exactly. Now, when you're selecting a blue cheese for sauce, you want to think about the moisture of that blue cheese. So you don't want to choose drier, harder, and often nuttier blue cheeses. Those are going to be harder to incorporate in a sauce because they don't melt as well, because they don't themselves carry that much moisture. And moisture is a really important factor in the meltability of a cheese. And also, you're going to end up, those cheeses tend to be more aged, a drier, harder, craggier blue cheese. And so they have like a more intense flavor.
Do those tend to be like, sometimes you eat a blue cheese and it's, you have that intense blue mold flavor, but you also have like a spiciness, like it almost bites you back?
For sure. I mean, I think specifically of like some of the more aged Spanish blue cheeses, you definitely get that like spiciness.
Yeah, where it actually like feels like it's tickling.
Yeah, and going back to Gorgonzola, actually, there's a Gorgonzola called Gorgonzola Picante, which is a more aged, sort of denser, craggier blue cheese, and that gives that kind of spiciness on the finish.
Interesting.
Was this helpful? I mean, I feel like I could talk to you for, you know, we would need a whole day at least.
I don't mind talking about cheese or eating cheese for days. What would be the use for like a really craggly, biteful sort of blue cheese? Where would you maybe use that? Or where,
yeah,
where,
so,
say if you bought one by mistake.
Yeah. So, you know, I think putting that on a cheese plate is a good idea. In my mind, those cheeses are really finished products. They're meant to be enjoyed as they are. The cheese maker and the affineur have spent a lot of time, you know, 6 months, sometimes a year, to create that product. And so that can go on a cheese plate. But also, I think those are good for salads, you know, just to crumble a little bit, just as an accent, you know, not necessarily to make the center of a salad, but to use as punctuation, like especially if you're going to put fruits in that salad, for instance, like you would see a cheese like that in a salad that has greens, that has nuts, that has fruit, and then a little dab will do ya. You know, a little bit of that cheese sort of crumbled so that it's part of a larger story, not like the main event.
Excellent. Wow. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Cool. Thanks for the call, Eddie.
Thank you, guys. And I'm going to like go to Whole Foods and like try all the cheeses there now. Really, seriously, thank you so much.
All right.
Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
All right, I think we have to take a little break, but Tia, can you stick around for a little longer?
I'd love that.
Right on. So coming up, we have more of your calls with cheese specialist Tia Keenan, and America's Test Kitchen weighs in on freezing your cheese. I'm Francis Lam, and God, you should have seen Tia's face when I said freezing your cheese. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're taking your calls about all things cheese right now, and I have a special guest, Tia Keenan, a cheese specialist and author of Melt, Stretch, and Sizzle, is here in the studio with me. Tia, you ready for another one?
I'm ready. I'm so excited to be here.
All right, we have Amanda from Berks County, Pennsylvania. Hey, Amanda.
Hi, Amanda.
Oh, hi. So I had a question. My husband and I host Cheese I Never Heard Of parties, which are grammatically imperfect but always delicious. At these parties, we invite guests to bring a cheese that they've never heard of. And it's a really fun party. It really gets people talking and mixing the crowd in a great organic fashion. I was just wondering, what cheeses would you bring to our party?
Well, first of all, I love, love, love this idea. Because the best way to learn about cheese is to, one, eat a lot of cheese, and two, eat a lot of different kinds of cheese. And I love the joie de vivre of this. So you're asking me what cheeses I would bring to that party?
Right. What would you recommend for guests to check out and bring that you suspect that they probably have never heard of?
Well, I think if you are lucky enough to live near a cheese shop or a larger specialty food shop or even a supermarket that has a cheesemonger, is to develop a relationship with that cheesemonger and to ask them what they're eating. There's always a cheese that the cheesemonger is like has on their brain that day.
So into you right now.
Now, if you don't buy your cheese from a store that has a cheesemonger, then I would think about going for maybe a category that maybe feels intimidating, that maybe isn't your favorite category of cheese, and just taking that chance. This is all about releasing yourself to the possibility of discovery. So why not let that guide the entire process? If you love brie, to say, okay, I'm gonna get a French cheese, but I'm not gonna get the French cheese that I always get. I'm gonna get a French cheese
that's completely
unknown to me, and go with that route. So take some of the knowledge that you have, and then like swerve, make a right turn.
Let me ask you a question, Tia, because one thing that is scary for people is, well, what if I buy a cheese I just hate? Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, it's like, what if I buy a cheese that's just super stinky? You know,
yeah.
If you have that in front of you, is there a way you can still learn to enjoy it? Or is it just like, is there something you can do to mitigate a cheese that's too stinky and still try to get something out of it? Or is it just like, I don't want to buy this thing and find I don't like it and have to like toss it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the pain can be very real because cheese is, for most of us, really, you know, it can be a luxury item. It's gonna be a hefty spend on your grocery bill. Mm-hmm. I think pairings are a great way to try to rein in a cheese.
Okay.
So, like, if you buy a cheese that you feel is too stinky, that's usually going to be in the wash rind category. Acidity can really rein that cheese in and change the whole experience for you. Mm. So, you know, Munster would be one of the most famous wash rind stinky cheeses. There's a reason that when you go to the part of France where Munster comes from, it's served with the things it's served with. Now, typically it's served with mustard. It's served with pickles. It's served with onions. Mm. These are all things that can take it down a notch and sort of create a more balanced bite.
Yeah.
So thinking about pairings, blue cheese. Typical condiments with blue cheese are often like sweeter condiments, things like honey or dried fruits. Blue cheese can be aggressive. So we take something sweet to sort of bring it in and make it more of a complete nuanced bite.
Yeah, like so a I think, pear or something.
It's yeah, so I think thing, right? Pairings are a good way to bring a cheese in if you're feeling like it's escaping you.
Well, that's a really great idea, and that as the party host, I always try to provide different options for pairings of the cheeses, but having the stronger pickles and onions is definitely something I'll implement in the future.
Yeah, and you can do that not just with condiments, but also with beverages. So, for instance, a stinky cheese or a blue cheese with a sweet wine or a port. You know, the traditional pairings with cheeses like that are there for a reason, and it's really to answer some of the concerns that you talk about.
Thanks for the call, Amanda. I love your cheese.
Amanda, I love it. It's like a G-rated key party. I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Tia, party's hard. So can you settle a debate once and for all? Do you eat the rind?
Oh, Francis. Short answer, yes.
Okay.
But it's complicated.
Oh, boy.
If it's a soft cheese, you should always eat the rind.
Okay.
If it's a hard cheese, it's up for debate.
That's fair. I know, like a Parmesan rind, I keep my Parmesan rinds and you can like throw them into things, like into a stock or a broth and like essentially like infuse.
Yeah.
And then take it out.
Yeah. You wouldn't want to eat just a straight up Parm rind.
Yeah.
But you can use, you can distill the flavor out of it.
Right.
In soups and broths for sure.
And that's delicious.
Risotto. I mean, I throw it into all kinds of things. Braises.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But some hard cheese rinds are gross.
I think if it looks like it's going to be dirt in your mouth, then you don't eat it. If it's waxed, you definitely don't eat it.
Right. Okay.
But soft ripened cheeses, soft cheeses with white rinds or washed rind cheeses, always eat the rind. The rind is an expression of the cheese. And the cheesemaker makes that rind with the intention that you are going to eat that.
So when you're at that party and you are at the cheese board and you see people just digging out all the creamy paste from a cheese and just leaving that rind just sagging and like collapsing on itself, don't be that guy. Don't be that gal. Don't do that to the cheese.
You wouldn't eat a pie by taking out its filling and leaving the crust behind. So just take the whole piece of pie, take the whole piece of cheese, and eat it. That's what you were meant to do.
It's the dignity. It's the dignity of the cheese.
It is.
The dignity of the pie. Just leaving it saggy and forlorn. Don't do that to the cheese.
No.
All right. Tia, this has been so fun.
I could do this all day, Francis.
I don't want to leave. Let's just like, guys, can we get some more callers?
Yeah, it's
just
like Cheese Abby. Like that.
All right, well, thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me. Really a pleasure.
Tia Keenan is author of The Art of the Cheese Plate and her latest Melt, Stretch, and Sizzle, The Art of Cooking Cheese. And she left us with a recipe for truly one of the greatest dishes on earth, this super stretchy, cheesy mashed potato called Palm Aligo. It's unreal. That's A-L-I-G-O-T. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. Okay, you followed Tia's advice. You've shelled out for great cheese. Now you're home. And now what? How do you store it? Is that smell okay? America's Test Kitchen has answers to these and many more questions. And Sally Swift asked Jack Bishop all of them.
Hey, Jack, great to have you back.
Great to chat with you, Sally.
So I have to tell you, our family has this tradition around the table when we get together, and we call it Lucy Questions, which is the name of our youngest. And you essentially go around the table, and everyone takes a turn and gets to ask the table a question. And it can be anything, like what superpower would you want, to everyone is drowning and who would you save, to what is the food you cannot live without. And it is amazing how many people say cheese. It is really a spectacular invention. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I want to come to a family meal at your house. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you're going to force me to take three foods with me, I mean, do we count wine as a food? Because I want to take wine, cheese, and bread.
You and the rest of us. So I want to talk today about the cheese element of that trio and about how we should be handling our cheese at home. Because I feel like, I mean, let me just start at the very top. Like, is plastic wrap okay for cheese?
Not really. So the paper that you get at a nice cheese shop actually does two things. It prevents the cheese from drying out quickly, but also allows it to breathe. You know, the cheese is continuing to live. The mold is doing its thing. And plastic wrap traps all that moisture on there. So you get the cheese going rotten faster. And it can get moldy spots. And at home, if you don't have cheese paper, which pretty much nobody does, that you can replicate it by using waxed paper or parchment and then wrapping that loosely in aluminum foil. And that two layers sort of protects the cheese from drying out. At the same time, it allows it to breathe a little bit.
Okay, that makes total sense. And why do some, particularly expensive cheeses, sometimes come with such a strong smell of ammonia when you unwrap them?
I know that you are now wrapping your cheese in plastic, Sally. You're caught. So this is really fascinating. So surface-ripened cheeses like a Brie or a Camembert, you know, that mold is continuing to interact with the milk proteins and producing flavor compounds, and they're getting trapped by the plastic. And so you get this hit of ammonia. Mm-hmm. Now, if you unwrap the cheese, which you should be, and letting it sit out for an hour, it should dissipate. I mean, if you're still smelling ammonia an hour later after unwrapping the cheese, it's gone bad and you need to throw it out. But that hit of something that's not very good will dissipate, and just let the cheese breathe a little bit before you eat it.
I've been suffocating my cheeses. It's absolutely terrible. What about freezing cheese? Is there cheese that you can freeze?
Yeah, I didn't believe this when we did this in the test kitchen, because I was like, you don't freeze cheese. I mean, that's an anathema to a beautiful piece of cheese.
Right.
But the reality is there are times where we, you know, we're going away and we've got cheese that we want to protect, or you see a great deal. And so there are certain cheeses. We found Camembert, Brie, goat cheese all freeze quite well.
You're kidding.
Yeah, and you just wrap them in plastic. In this case, the plastic is okay. And then throw them into a Ziploc bag and then defrost them in the fridge. And they're fine a month, 2 months later. The drier cheeses, like a cheddar or Parmesan, they suffer a bit. The flavor is off and the texture really isn't the same. But, you know, if you see a two-for-one special for Camembert, mm-hmm. you can certainly freeze one of them and it'll be fine for a couple months in your freezer.
Wow, that's very interesting. Let's talk about harder cheeses. So let's talk about Parmigiano. Should we be buying grated Parmigiano or not at all? Never.
There are two things that I worry about. One is, what are you really buying? You know, is it the good stuff or mm-hmm. is it a substitute?
Who knows, right?
You know, and you can validate that based on what the market is and how comfortable you know the people at the market. But the other issue is, when was it grated? And so this applies whether you're buying it at the supermarket or you want to pre-grate the cheese at home and then throw it in the fridge, is that we found after a week you can taste the difference, which is that everything is muted. The flavors are just mm-hmm. not as good. And after 2 weeks, it really doesn't taste very good at all. And so, you know, if your supermarket is grating their Parmesan and it's been sitting there for a month, you know, it's basically sawdust with a little bit of cheese flavor.
And if we are going to splurge and buy the queen of all cheeses, Parmigiano Reggiano, is there, you know, you see the pieces with the rind on it. Is there a best part of the wheel that you should be looking for, a piece from the middle or from the sides?
Yeah, I love, we did this test where we took a whole big wheel, you know, it's 80 pounds,
yeah.
and basically I think we're like geologists up in Greenland taking core samples from different parts of the cheese, and it turns out the corner pieces are the best. So you think about like a big turkey that cooks from the outside in, and you're waiting and waiting for that big roast of the turkey to heat up in the center while the outside is way overcooked. The aging process works the same way. It starts on the outside of the wheel. Mm. And aging is what makes Parmigiano so incredibly delicious. Mm-hmm. And so those exterior portions, especially a corner, get more aging. And you get more of those little crystals. We actually measure mm-hmm. the crystals and found twice as many of those little crystals, mm-hmm. the thing that makes it so delicious in those exterior pieces. So you definitely want the rind. And if you see two rind, you know, on mm-hmm. two different sides, then you know, well, that's the most aged part of the wheel.
And you can use those rinds, right? That is something that I do stash in my freezer, our Parmigiano rinds.
Yes, never. I'm so glad to hear that. Never, ever throw out a rind from a nice Parmigiano. Throw it in a freezer bag and then put it in a pot of beans, minestrone mm-hmm. soup. It adds so much flavor. I personally use them instead of commercial stocks. If you just want to use water and a vegetable and bean soup but feel like, well, the water's going to be kind of bland, that rind really adds a lot of flavor. It will soften up, release a lot of flavor, and then, of course, toss it out before you serve the soup. But it's delicious for that purpose.
So, Jack, is there a difference between using a rasp grater, you know, the finer one, versus a box grater when you're measuring out a half a cup of grated cheese?
Yeah, I've spent way too much of my adult life thinking about how to write a recipe. but it's true, as have my colleagues. And one of the things we have noticed is, you know, with the introduction of those rasp-style graters, that suddenly everybody's grated Parmesan or Asiago was a lot fluffier. And so, in fact, a ounce of cheese grated on that rasp-style grater probably is about a half a cup volume. Mm-hmm. That same ounce is only a quarter cup on a box grater. And so if you're measuring by volume, you know, you're using your cup measures rather than right. your scale, you know, you can either have half as much or twice as much cheese as you really want in the recipe. And so it's a good reason to, yet again, use your scale whenever you can when you are in the kitchen.
Okay, so Jack, my last question. Pick your favorite cheese, and how do you like to use it?
Well, that's a little like asking me to pick my favorite children. How about I pick my favorite simple recipe and the cheese that you use for it?
Okay.
I love, as you know, Sally, all things Italian. And in the Northeast, in Friuli, they make this little cocktail aperitif called fricco. It's like a thin, crispy wafer that has one ingredient, cheese.
Mm-hmm.
The local cheese is Montasio. You can use an aged Asiago. And you just simply grate it, and then you spread it out in a nonstick pan. Cook it till it's brown on the first side, then slip a spatula underneath, and brown it on the second side. 2, 4, 6 minutes, depending on how hot your pan is. And oh my heavens, it's just, you've cooked something, but it's still 100% cheese.
And nothing better with a beautiful glass of wine. What a great idea. Thank you, Jack.
Thanks, Sally.
Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer at America's Test Kitchen, and you can find the recipe he talked about for fricco at splendidtable.org. And if you make it, you should try this. After you make your fricco, like when it's still warm in the pan, take it out and drape it over an upturned bowl. And it'll harden into a crispy little cheese basket that you can stick like Caesar salad into or whatever, because I used to work for a wedding caterer in Michigan in the 90s, and people would go bananas for crispy cheese baskets. Like, I don't know if I can recommend like tying green beans with chives into little bundles anymore, but crispy cheese baskets, still pretty good. And with that, it is time to say goodbye. We will see you next week, and we'll make friends with a cheesemonger. Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our weekly email, Weeknight Kitchen. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.